nuclear films, nuclear filmmakers, and a devastating loss. It's always painful to lose a great member of the underpopulated movement against nukes, and the recent passing of James Heddle, Jim, is not only a loss for our community, but a personal loss for me as well. Jim, the director of SOS, the San Onofre Syndrome, along with his life partner Mary Beth Brangan and Morgan Peterson, provided decades of consistent, relentless film and video coverage of the resistance actions against all things nuclear. It was where he observed and developed a central philosophy, and when he told us,
"Citizens, that's been an important part of this whole story, and that's why we wanted to show the process of citizen action impacting the eventual shutdown, even though Edison wanted to diminish that impact. It's really significant, and we wanted to use that as an encouraging example for other people to follow and to see that it really is possible for a small handful of really well-informed, persistent citizens to have an impact on City Hall."
That he did. Jim Heddle was right about that and so much more. And his voice lives on in his legacy of films that warn us with great compassion and understanding about that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear, who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we memorialize James Heddle, director and videographer of the film San Onofre Syndrome, who was a fierce but gentle presence in the resistance to all things nuclear. We'll have an interview I conducted with Jim and his life and work partner, Mary Beth Brangan, 2 years ago on the premiere of their groundbreaking award-winning film, SOS, The San Onofre Syndrome. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world. Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story. Alistair Burnett of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons with the ICAN Update. And more honest information than you'll find anywhere on network television, except for sometimes the late-night comedy shows. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, November 25th, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out in the U.S., where it was a totally nutty week in D.C., including, and especially, in the nuclear sector. Here's Linda Pence Gunter to explain in this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
How crazy are things in the United States right now? In the space of a week, President Trump called for members of Congress to be executed while fawning over Zoran Mamdani, the mayor-elect of New York, who he'd labeled 100% communist lunatic and a total nutjob. Trump also shrugged off the execution and dismembering of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi while meeting with the undoubted perpetrator, Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, saying, "Things happen," even though U.S. intelligence concluded without a doubt that the Crown Prince had ordered the killing. Trump reprimanded a female reporter for directly questioning the Crown Prince about Khashoggi, telling her, "You don't have to embarrass our guest." Guest? Okay, not geopolitics then. And oh yes, Trump also called another female reporter Piggy for asking a legitimate question about the Epstein files. Meanwhile, wild-eyed MAGA disciple Marjorie Taylor Greene announced she was quitting Congress in January, tired of being labeled Marjorie Traitor Greene by Trump for standing up for affordable health care, among other things Trump doesn't like. She'd also broken ranks by becoming the first and still only Republican and almost the only member of Congress to call what Israel is doing in Gaza a genocide. Like I said, all pretty mad, so it was no big surprise when the nuclear week that was turned out to be a roller coaster of insanity as well. The Department of Energy announced that the bulk of all energy subsidies will go to nuclear power, including $80 billion to Westinghouse, that has both been tasked with and promises to build 10 full-size new AP1000 reactors by 2030. I love the smell of marijuana in the morning. But moving on. After a meeting with Japan's new right-wing Prime Minister, Sanae Takaichi, a country that has already agreed to invest $550 billion in US infrastructure, the Trump administration announced that $332 billion of that would specifically support domestic energy projects, including, yes, those 10 Westinghouse AP1000 reactors. To cap it off, we then learned that the US government itself would become a shareholder in the Westinghouse project, allowing the administration to require an initial public offering on or before January 2029 if the company's value surges to $30 billion or more. The government would then become an 8% shareholder in Westinghouse. Westinghouse itself isn't strictly a US company anymore, having first gone bankrupt due to, yes, its ambitious AP1000 new reactor build in South Carolina that almost put its parent company, Japan's Toshiba, into bankruptcy as well. The two South Carolina reactors were abandoned, although there's talk now, of course, of reviving them. Westinghouse did complete its two AP1000 reactors at the Vogtle site in Georgia, but only after running tens of billions of dollars over budget and coming in years late. Despite this, Westinghouse was salvaged by its new owners, Cameco and Brookfield Asset Management, two companies from Canada, which, last time I looked, is not yet the 51st US state. So much for domestic energy independence. We're still reeling here in DC from the bulldozing of the East Wing of the White House to be replaced with a giant gaudy ballroom in which to wine and dine Trump's friends, who almost all happen to be the same billionaires and assorted oligarchs hoping to get handouts for their nuclear power projects. Google, Apple, Amazon, Meta, and Palantir are all investors in the ballroom and angling for a fast build-out of new nuclear reactors and the revival of some closed ones to power their giant data centers. Another ballroom investor is Lockheed Martin, a major player in the nuclear weapons sector. And just in case we missed the connection between the civil and military nuclear sectors, the US Army announced last week it had released a solicitation asking vendors to propose micro-reactor designs that the Army would site on 9 separate bases between now and, yes, 2030. There are a lot of promises to be realized by 2030, so let's get the abacus out. Assuming all these projects are to be up and running by the start of that year, that's 4 years from now. Do you reckon 10 AP1000s and scores of micro-reactors will be up and running by then? No, I didn't think so. Some of us have our heads screwed on the right way around, and we prefer croissants to cannabis for our breakfast. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
Over to Japan and the Far East, where China will reimpose a ban on imports of Japanese seafood products. The ban would effectively be a return to one put in place in August 2023, following Japan's release of what they call treated wastewater, meaning still radioactive wastewater from Fukushima, into the Pacific Ocean. Tokyo and Beijing had reached an agreement in September last year to resume imports, with Japan confirming the first shipment of seafood to China less than 2 weeks ago. NHK, the Japanese broadcaster, said that China had explained that the ban was necessary in order to monitor the wastewater being released from the Fukushima reactors, with the import halt lasting, quote, for the foreseeable future. In a retaliatory move, Taiwan on Friday lifted its import restrictions on Japanese food products, which were imposed following the 2011 triple meltdown at the tsunami-crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant in Fukushima Prefecture. Taiwan will no longer require certificates of origin for all Japanese food items or radiation inspection reports for products from the five Japanese prefectures of Fukushima, Ibaraki, Tochigi, Gunma, and Chiba. To underscore this decision, Taiwan President Lai Ching-te posted pictures online of his lunch, featuring sashimi and sushi, including scallops and yellowtail. Meanwhile, the United States has never had any kind of ban on seafood from Japan and will allow up to 1,200 becquerels per kilogram, that's a measure of radiation, becquerels per kilogram of seafood to be imported with no notice and no restrictions. With the exception of the EU, the United States permits more radiation in its imports than any other country. Now for the international news. Here's Alistair Burnett of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, direct from their headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland.
Hi, this is Alistair Burnett from ICAN in Geneva with the latest from the Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. You'd be forgiven for thinking you were back in the early 1980s with nuclear weapons news the way it is. The past month has seen full-scale nuclear exercises by both Russia and the United States, France announcing a modernized nuclear missile for its submarines. Russian President Putin has trumpeted the successful testing of two new nuclear weapons, an underwater drone, and a nuclear-powered cruise missile that has been dubbed the Flying Chernobyl for its obvious risk of causing radiological contamination when it explodes, even if armed with a conventional warhead. This has been capped off with an escalation of nuclear rhetoric by President Trump when he announced he'd ordered the Pentagon to start nuclear testing. What this means is unclear, but the Secretary of Energy, who heads the department responsible for nuclear weapons, says this would not involve explosive tests of actual warheads. President Putin responded by saying he'd ordered plans to be made for resuming nuclear tests if the US does so. Neither country has carried out a nuclear test detonation since the 1990s, as an effective moratorium has been in place. The only country to carry out a test this century has been North Korea, the last one being in 2017. The messages from the White House have been confusing, to say the least, and perhaps that's part of the point. But Russia has asked for clarification. At time of recording, Moscow says it has yet to receive any official communication from Washington. To muddy the waters further, President Trump has also said he plans denuclearization talks with Russia and China. Russia has not responded directly to that, but said it has suggested talks on extending the New START treaty with the US, which is due to expire next February. But that's not the same thing as denuclearization. China has said the US and Russia must go first, as they have much larger arsenals. The US and Russia have more than 5,000 nuclear warheads to China's estimated 600. Where this is all headed remains unclear, but the ramping up of rhetoric between the US and Russia is escalating tensions already high due to Western support for Ukraine in its war with Moscow. If President Trump really wants the Nobel Peace Prize, this is not the way to go about it. He needs to de-escalate and open talks with Putin on reducing and getting rid of their arsenals, and a reminder that between them, they control 87% of all nuclear weapons in the world. The threat of nuclear war is also back in the cultural zeitgeist. Director Catherine Bigelow's new movie, House of Dynamite, has been attracting big audiences and a lot of comment. The Pentagon and its media and think tank allies have even felt the need to undermine it by questioning its accuracy. Here in Geneva, ICAN has been working with Italian artist Enrico Muratore, who has produced a project called Pro Memoria, Sending Out an SOS. Pro Memoria means reminder in Italian. It began as a series of paintings called Radioactive Beasts and is now a multimedia project with a book, video, song and live readings. An exhibition of the work is on in Geneva at the moment with support from ICAN. So I spoke to Enrico Muratore and asked him what had inspired him.
In 2022, with the invasion of Ukraine, I felt like many others did that this was a new kind of war, a bigger war than the ones that had characterized the first 20 years of this century. One that had a bigger potential for destruction and annihilation, because this war was characterized by the participation and is still characterized by the participation of nuclear superpowers, and therefore it has the potential for really going very far. So I felt that as an artist I had to respond to that through a project that was trying to, and is trying still to promote understanding that we cannot really play with fire, that there will be no survivor if there is a nuclear war, that people seem to have really forgotten the lessons of the past. So I think art has to play a role in this sense, to really try to give the wake-up call.
Through your pictures, you used very vivid colours and animals. What was the inspiration for that?
As soon as the war in Ukraine started, the general handling of the situation by the media was such that I felt we were already in an Orwellian tale again. So I decided to inspire myself especially from Animal Farm, because I see the world as a farm where three pigs that represent three different geopolitical superpowers, like in 1984, by the way, are owning the farm, but they are not satisfied with their share. They want it all, so they have their dogs dressed to become warriors, the dogs of war, and they have their sheep who are the propagandists. Like today we see a number of politicians and journalists that are pushing for war, although this war is going to destroy them too. I depict all of that possible dystopian future, but also there is a second part of the story, which is called The Happy Beast, when a young donkey finally revolts and kicks the dogs of war in their butt and pushes them to the sky and to the air, along with the cats that were collaborating with the enemy. And so the whole farm revolts at that point, and they manage to drive the pigs away, and the pigs flee. And they are eaten by my dog, in the story. And then there is also a number of paintings that depict the reconciliation by the dog and the cat and all the rest of the animals. And the promise to remember, not to forget, promemoria means remember, that there are things that you can do every day, but there are things to never do, for example, war.
So why do you think art can carry a message in the anti-nuclear campaign that is now global in a way that words can't?
Art, first of all, to be art needs to be relevant to the present we are living, and also to contribute to the construction of a future. It's part of the intellectual and cultural work that we need to do to guide the society in different directions. So what we need to do is to engage as many artists as possible to promote a message of peace. We have to talk about the beast, we have to represent it, the beast of war. We have to let the people understand what will be the consequences in terms of the total disruption of our society. Artists have to raise awareness. So that is why I align with ICANN. Today, artists need to step out of the comfort zone, decoration, interior design, things that are done just to please the rare rich people who still buy some paintings, but really commit to change society and bring it to a future of peace, a future for our youth, for our children, in a world that is really going nuts.
That was Enrico Muratore. If you want to see some of his art, search for Enrico Muratore, that's Muratore, and Radioactive Beasts on the web. This is Alistair Burnett, ending this news roundup for Nuclear Hot Seat.
We'll have this week's featured interview up in just a moment, but first, we're entering the holiday gift-giving season, which reminds me of something my mother used to say. You can't play with your toys until you've cleaned up the mess in your room. I wish she were here to tell that to the nuclear industry. See, they love playing with their toys, the bombs, the reactors, because they're all moneymakers to the industry's Ponzi scheme, which has succeeded in foisting nuclear upon a well-propagandized public. But they never clean up their room, meaning the planet they populated and, oh yes, us. They might give it a lick and a promise, which they know they will not be keeping because they always leave behind a deadly mess. Radioactive materials left over from uranium mining, transport, refinement, reactor operations, so-called spent fuel rods that still contain plenty of plutonium to spend, accidents, and the forever problem of nuclear waste. The nukesters use well-focused grouped talking points along with smoke and mirrors to make it seem like they're responsible citizens. And mainstream media falls for it again and again, as do politicians, the general public, even some so-called environmentalists. It's hard to learn the hard truths about this industry, and that is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We know where to look for the real nuclear story, know the questions to ask, and report on the ongoing evolving nuclear truth that the industry would rather we not hear about, let alone understand, and mainstream reporters don't know to ask or don't have the time or space to put it in their reports. In order to keep doing this work, we need your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs exclusively on donations and cannot survive without your support. So especially this holiday season, if you're grateful for the information you get from the show, now's the time to help us out. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. And we make it easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. Or you can send a donation directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Be it a one-time donation or monthly recurring, you'll be supporting the services required to keep this program running. So please, don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate now and help keep our nuclear news online. Whatever you can do to help, know that I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. This week's story is very sad and very personal. Film director and activist Jim Heddle passed away suddenly and unexpectedly 2 weeks ago. He and his life and work partner, Mary Beth Brangan, are award-winning documentary video and radio producers, educators, and organizers. Jim and Mary Beth co-directed EON, the Ecological Options Network, and Team SOS, producing documentaries, video reports, and blogs on issues, activists, and organizations globally working for solutions to planetary challenges. Their most recent project, where they also teamed with filmmaker Morgan Peterson, is the award-winning film SOS, The San Onofre Syndrome, which premiered in 2023. To memorialize his passing, Nuclear Hot Seat is presenting an interview conducted in 2023 with Jim and Mary Beth, when SOS, The San Onofre Syndrome, was about to be premiered. This interview took place on September 22, 2023. When I first became involved in nuclear issues, after Fukushima, I went to meetings and protests in Southern California, knowing little, asking lots, and learning who the players were in this battle against nuclear threats and dangers, most specifically here in my own backyard. San Onofre is only 70 miles from my home, and I took its presence personally. From the first events I attended, there was this couple with much better than cell phone cameras and sound equipment, and they were shooting footage of everything, every time. As I learned, Mary Beth Brangan and Jim Heddle have long been dedicated to documenting activist pushback against the entrenched nuclear industry. Their company, EON, Ecological Options Network, is dedicated to supporting grassroots movements working for planetary and human rights through deep democracy. Documentary films take a long time to put together, in this case, more than 12 years. But the result of Jim and Mary Beth's Herculean efforts is well worth the wait. This extraordinary film presents a roller coaster ride of hope, crushing setbacks, and persistence. It cites dozens of genuine experts, many of whom I've interviewed here on Nuclear Hot Seat, and puts together the best sound bites from those passionate, persistent activists. The film paints the picture of betrayal, manipulation, and lies by an industry that cares not one whit about people and the environment. But it's not just talking heads. There's animation to bring otherwise dry statistics to visual life. Historic newscasts, horrifying footage from Fukushima, as well as San Onofre. And it's all woven together in a seamless narrative based on human lives that never lags, always engages, and leaves one with a massive impulse to get involved. And if it sounds like, at times, I'm taking this personally, you're right. I spoke with Mary Beth Brangen and Jim Heddle on Friday, September 22nd, 2023. Mary Beth Brangen and Jim Heddle, it's so great to finally be able to welcome you here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
We're honored.
First of all, congratulations, standing ovation. Your film, SOS San Onofre Syndrome, is powerful, ultimate, and a perception-changing film on the nuclear mess at San Onofre and far beyond. And as is clear from the excellence of the way this film is put together, this ain't your first rodeo. Briefly, what's your background as filmmakers?
I guess it begins with me learning how to use my father's 8mm camera. After that, I went to film school in Britain and then worked on various productions. And then I began teaching filmmaking at various universities in this country, University of Wisconsin in Madison and Concordia University in Montreal, and eventually escaped academia and went freelance. And I've been doing it ever since. The most successful move in my career was hooking up with Mary Beth.
Oh, and when I found out Jim's background, I thought, aha, this is the person for me. He's going to teach me how to be a filmmaker.
Can you imagine having somebody say, as she said to me, just figure out what you want to do and I'll make it happen. And she has.
So you've made other films happen in the past. This one has been cooking for a very long time. I only joined the anti-nuclear movement after Fukushima. It was the first time I got my legs under me after Three Mile Island. And one of my first memories from my earliest post-Fukushima activism was seeing the two of you hanging on to impressive cameras, recording, meeting, and events that I went to throughout Southern California. How long have you been covering Southern California's anti-nuclear movement and specifically San Onofre?
Well, you know, right after Fukushima started, and I say started because it's definitely ongoing, we realized, oh my God, as filmmakers and anti-nuclear activists, we must take it on ourselves to try to prevent a Fukushima from happening here in California. And that's when we worked with others across the state to help revive the former strong anti-nuclear movement, again, to close our last two remaining operating nuclear power plants, which were also, just like Fukushima, surrounded by earthquake faults and in tsunami zones. So we've been doing this since 2011.
You're not from the Los Angeles or Southern California area, so you had to travel to cover all the many meetings and demonstrations and events that you did record. What moved and motivated you to keep covering it so consistently? I mean, you never dropped a beat. I always saw you no matter where I showed up.
Yeah, that was part of the problem because we accumulated thousands of hours that we then had to go through.
We set out to cover both Diablo Canyon and San Onofre, and it became increasingly evident, particularly once we started working with an editor, that it was just too big a story. We had to break it in two pieces, and we're still hoping to do the Diablo Canyon syndrome after we get through putting this out in the world to make its way.
That was one of the astonishing things, because the breadth and the depth of the information, the people you interviewed, the experts, the genuine experts, many of whom I've had on the show, some of whom I count as personal friends now, who were featured in the show, is astonishing. And you would take someone like Dan Hirsch from the Committee to Bridge the Gap, and you would take a brilliant sentence or two sentences that he would have said that I know must have been from like an hour or two of talking. How in the world did you approach this mountain of material to put it into the precise, clear, and informative order that you did?
Well, we had to develop a timeline, and of course we had transcripts, and we gradually put it together with the help of our brilliant editor, who happens to be Mary Beth's niece, Morgan Peterson. She's also the co-director of this piece.
Because she figured it out. I mean, she really pulled the storylines through, digging through thousands of hours. I mean, really, she did an incredible job.
Was the editing ongoing as you were working on this, or did you wait until you got to an end point to see what you had and put it together?
No, well, it was ongoing.
Yeah, it was ongoing. Well, actually, the construction of this particular piece, I guess, began 7 or 8 years ago when we began to feel like we had a hold of something.
Yeah, and we first thought we were going to be focusing on shutting down. And then we realized, no, that's just the first part of the story. In fact, there was a byline that we got very attached to, which was, shutdown is only the beginning, unfortunately.
You broke the film into two parts, and it was almost like a two-part series on television or the like, because the first part was so much about what did it take to shut it down. Mm-hmm. And I was at a vast number of those meetings. I didn't show up on camera in any of it.
Yes, you did. Yes, you were. You were in the front row at Naota Khan's event. You're sitting in the front row.
There I am taking my notes and sticking my recorder in front of whoever would talk to me. That was part of the astonishment of who you had in. I mean, you had former Prime Minister of Japan, Naoto Kan, who was in charge during Fukushima. You had so many people from Edison who I recognize, though you didn't catch Tom Palmisano in the middle of one of his grand mal physical physics, which is, talk about a tell from a poker game. This guy had a tell for the fact that he was really under a lot of pressure and not telling the truth, because he would twitch every time he started saying certain things. Plus, the range of the activists, some of whom are no longer with us. I mean, to see Jean Stone and
Barbara George,
who you dedicated the film to, who was such a valiant worker in dealing with the California Utilities Commission. She knew chapter and verse on them. Did you find that it was difficult dealing with so many different people, or that you had a difficulty honing in on which ones became more a part of the narrative as opposed to drop-ins?
Yeah, it's hard, you see, because there's so many wonderful activists with so many points of view that make such wonderful contributions. And we just had to focus on how to tell the story in the most personalized way. Remember, Eisenhower said that the only way to defend against the danger that he saw looming was informed, vigilant citizens. And that's been an important part of this whole story, and that's why we wanted to show the process of citizen action impacting the eventual shutdown, even though Edison wanted to diminish that impact. It's really significant, and we wanted to use that as an encouraging example for other people to follow and to see that it really is possible for a small handful of really well-informed, persistent citizens to have an impact on City Hall.
It was really hard to leave anybody out, and that's why at the end, over the credits, we have flashes of so many of the wonderful people that did work on it. And we also dedicated this to Burton Muldo, who also was a safety advocate at San Onofre for many years. He also has passed on.
Yeah, and Gene Stone passed on. And kids grew up during this. So you noticed in the film, the Johnson family moves from babyhood into speaking at the microphone themselves. It's, It's really quite wonderful.
And doing an excellent job of it. That was, I think, such a valuable part of the film, that you did show the process of the activists coming together and how the powers that be did everything in their power to thwart the citizens speaking the truth, down to limiting how long you could speak and what you could speak on and when you could speak at these meetings. I think one of my favorite moments in the entire film was when Torgan Johnson explained that, well, they were limiting us. They would not let us do a 15-minute presentation with everything we wanted to say. So we broke it down into 3-minute segments. We stood in line, we went in order, and when one person stopped, the next person picked it up. And in that way, the entire presentation was given. It was just given by different voices. I thought that was a brilliant piece of information and one that could be emulated by groups anywhere.
Yeah, we really wanted people to know that. That's the way you magnify the individual voices and meld them into a continuous joint voice.
Also, I want to mention that it was a perfect storm, actually, that made them shut the reactors down and close it down for good, because it was not only the citizens' grassroots efforts, it was also the legal push that Friends of the Earth was able to make through the ASLB, which is the subset legal court of the NRC. They knew that they had them on a legal principle that they weren't going to get out of. And so it was a perfect storm between all the organizing at the bottom and the legal assault too, or defense.
Yeah, it isn't just citizen pressure in the streets. It's also the pressure in the courts and the appropriate venues for legal action.
We also were blessed with the totally unexpected yet brilliantly placed Donna Gilmore, who before Fukushima didn't know anything about this, didn't do anything about this, and happened to live in a beautiful home facing the ocean in San Clemente. And then she discovered she was only 5 miles away from San Onofre and started digging. The narrative following her through this, from admitting that she was a naive local resident all the way through having members of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission say that she had been educating them, which indeed she had through her research, and then to the final sadness, I won't mention what it is, but it deals with her home, I thought was a real through line that people could hang their awareness and their attention on. How someone came from out of nowhere in particular, who bought in, who dedicated herself, and who did the hard work every step of the way to be part of this and to provide the research on what was wrong, especially when it came to the storage of the materials.
Definitely. We were so blessed that she's got incredible researching skills and analytical prowess. I mean, because when you get right down to it, we're still searching for other people who have done that scope, breadth and depth into the storage issues, because it's not their favorite subject. A nuclear engineer in school, storage is an elective. Yes, Donna just found that out. And, you know, why would they want to take an elective on storing when the real sexy parts of the nuclear allure are not there? And it's incredibly important that Donna did that deep dive.
So this film honors a whole raft of activists who turned themselves into experts, maybe did not have the training or the background or the college prep courses for this, but through their own diligence and their own study, became experts, became spokespeople, became those individuals who knew the truth and could speak it and point it out to others. I was thrilled to realize that I knew personally probably 3/4 of the people who spoke on our side, on the side of shutting down San Onofre and having safe storage. And beyond that were people who I had interviewed already for the show in depth. And what heartened me was how precise you were in selecting the sweet spot of their knowledge
and their articulation and putting that in the film. How did you go about winnowing it down to, for however many hours you talked to, say, Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, to get those specific quotes from him? What did you have to do to hone it down?
Reams of transcripts and doing paper edits, endless paper edits, and each of us having our favorite sound bites to discuss and cobble into a sensible narration. You're right, it took a lot of winnowing to get it down to the streamlined version that you see on screen now.
I don't think there was one moment, one nano of flab where I went, oh, that could have been edited a little bit tighter, because I've got that in the back of my brain at all times. It's kind of like, oh, this is going to be a slow movie because it's badly edited in the first 5 minutes. Nuh-uh. This thing barreled ahead, and yet for all the intensity of information and intense information that you were providing, it was a clear, clean, smooth narrative that did not overwhelm because you provided so much of the human aspect of it. I mean, I cannot give you enough kudos on this film because I thought it was hands down brilliant, ultimate, and quite possibly a game changer in the dealing of the public with this entire industry.
Oh, Libby, thank you so much. That's beautiful.
Yeah, I wish Morgan was here to hear your kudos, too.
Yeah.
But we got really high praise from a New York activist who saw it the other day, and she said, SOS is for organizers. And I think that's largely a tribute to Mary Beth's input, because Mary Beth is the organizer in the family, and she used that perspective to polish the presentation from an activist point of view.
Was there a particular set of guidelines or perceptions or intentions on your part that you used to create the parameters for what you used and what you had to sadly put on the shelf for perhaps another time?
We sure do have a lot on that shelf for another time, I'll tell you. But I was constantly trying to winnow down to the basic issues that needed to be touched on, because even though we left out so much, it's still, you know, an hour and a half film. The issues that, you know, I'm part of the decommissioning working group that meets nationally every Friday morning, and people talk about these issues all the time, so I was reminded what comes up, what needed to be said, what are the key problems here.
Our intention was to make it catalytic and empowering for people in other reactor communities around the country. That was a fundamental intention right from the beginning. Because like we say in the title, this is a syndrome that isn't limited to San Onofre.
The ethical discussion, the discussion about values, that our whole intention could be summed up in that focus, I think, that Dan so beautifully articulates, that it's such a challenge ethically.
Yeah, the basic question we're asking is, what is the ethical, environmental, and technological best practice combination that could be applied to this universal problem? And it can't just be technological, it can't just be moral and ethical, it can't just be environmental, it has to be an amalgam of all those dimensions.
That's part of, I think, what made it so complex yet so accessible. Because again, you laid it out in measured pieces, where a lot of times I will be watching a film. I've been a judge for the International Uranium Film Festival, so I've seen a lot of films. And sometimes with all best intentions, a filmmaker gives too much, or it becomes too jargonish. And it becomes difficult for, say, a lay person to watch this and understand, well, what's important about this? And why does this relate to me? And what did they just say? And what does NRC mean? We can't take any of that for granted. And you didn't. The film is laid out so that even somebody who does not know about the issues can learn about them and can also learn what to do. So it's not just about, okay, here's a heap of bad news. It's like, here's a heap of bad news, and here's what you can do about it to empower yourself and empower your community and your neighbors to take action against the incursion of this deadly technology on our lives. And you basically gave them the script for how to proceed.
Thank you. I hope we did. And, you know, Gordon Edwards was so key. Oh, my God. When we heard him speak, of course, years ago, when Joanna Macy, who I don't know how many of your listeners know Joanna Macy, but she worked for years. She's a Buddhist scholar and anti-nuclear activist as well. And she came up with the concept of guardianship. It had to be, the nuclear waste had to be guarded. And I remember the first time I heard articulation of that concept, I burst into tears because I realized the importance of that understanding. And then when Gordon spoke about it at the conference in Chicago in 2015, I think it was, the NEIS organized for high-level radioactive waste focus nationally, and he spoke about the concept of rolling stewardship.
As opposed to abandonment.
Mm-hmm. And so we just thought, oh, that's it. That is it.
One of the first interviews of note that I did for Nuclear Hot Seat took a couple of months before people went, who's she? What's she do? Podcast? Who is this woman? One of the first big ones I got was Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear. And this was all new information to me at the time. So I was talking with him about what do we do with the waste? And he was talking about the need for a nuclear priesthood. He was talking about this Joanna Macy concept of taking care of it in the long run, and that there would have to be people who are dedicated to this as their service to mankind.
Right. And that's the rolling stewardship. I prefer to think of it as skilled workers intergenerationally rolling, over their skills, their understanding, and their knowledge so that the next generation has it to deal with. Yeah, a little bit less
religious culty,
tones.
Yeah.
I think it was the fact that he mentioned it as a priesthood that it really stuck with me, because that's a dedication of one's life to a set of beliefs. It doesn't have to be religious, but it is a dedication of a life. And that's what the rolling stewardship is as well.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Not just a life, but a whole societal orientation. Now, that's the key to it. It has to become a societal response, not just a minority enthusiasm.
And most people, of course, at this point, don't even really know what's going on with nuclear things. I think that's one of the reasons why the Oppenheimer film had such shock value to a younger generation, because Heidi Huttner, who made the film Radioactive, The Women of Three Mile Island, another excellent film. She's a teacher at Stony Brook University. So she's dealing with college kids, and she teaches ecofeminism around that topic. And she had the class come in, and she said in a class of 30 to 40 kids, two or three of them had heard of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They didn't know about Three Mile Island. They had maybe heard the term Chernobyl, but they didn't know what it represented. And because it's more recent, more of them had heard about Fukushima. But they really have no knowledge, no context, no understanding of what nuclear is. They think radiation, oh, that's the treatment that mom got for her breast cancer. Mm-hmm. They don't think of it as that may have been the thing that gave her the breast cancer in the first place.
Or it's going to rescue us from climate change.
Oh, yeah, that's a big lie. I work on that one every week.
So do we. I read Heidi saying that about her class, and I was just horrified, but not too surprised, because a couple of years ago, or several actually now, I went to a neighbor's eighth grade class to see if we could do some work with them, and looked at their textbooks, which were teaching them that nuclear was absolutely necessary. you know, and GMO to prevent starvation and all of this stuff. And then I discovered that the corporations were the ones who were writing the textbooks.
And they were writing it for an audience in Texas because they are the largest purchasers of textbooks. And they've had the whip hand on that industry for decades now, which is why so much of the information that we would recognize as being true and important and cutting edge has been completely wiped out. So we almost have to start at the ground and work our way up in education. And I think your film does a superb job of not only stating what the problems are, but how individuals can get together and form little groups, little conglomerates of people who can then organize, strategize, coordinate, and make a difference.
Yeah, there's a wider context that we don't really have time to go into in the film, but that is that nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, and nuclear waste are like Siamese twins joined at the hip. They're all part of what Albert Meyer and other activists are calling the nuclear enterprise. For years, the pro-nuclear faction have denied that there's any connection between energy and weaponry. But now they're using that as the excuse for continuing the civil nuclear energy program because it's a vital support in terms of labor pool, knowledge pool,
infrastructure,
and so on that supports the nuclear weapons enterprise and the nuclear navy, which is both propelled by and a delivery system for nuclear materials. And of course, both of those end up with the nuclear waste conundrum, for which even after 75 years, there's no perceivable solution. Eventually, I hope we'll be able to touch on that in future films if we live long enough. But I think this is a good start for alerting people to the perils involved.
I just want to add one thing, and that is the space program is a big promoter of the nuclear enterprise because they want to use it in all kinds of different...
Yeah, for power and delivery systems in space.
Right.
Give me a break.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and they want to have nuclear reactors for power on the moon. They want to have it on Mars and propel the ships there. Not thinking about the contamination risk that that poses for otherwise nuclear pristine environments that have not been contaminated. One of the, I think it was the Voyager that was crashed into Jupiter. It had a payload on it of something like 73 pounds of plutonium in an environment we know nothing about. We have now contaminated it with man-made radioactive materials with no idea how that is going to play out over the centuries and the millennia into the future. It's like we are setting ourselves up for God and manipulating something that is not going to go away, that will be with us for virtually eternity with no concept of what we are doing or how we can possibly turn it around.
Hello, we're the humans from Earth.
You know, that also reminds me in the 50s about atomic bombs detonated in the jet streams,
and
right?
The Van Allen radiation belt.
The Van Allen belts, yeah. It's just idiocy.
Looking in the immediate, not short-sighted, but the short term, what are your plans for the film? I know it's been edited and put together and the soundtrack, and you said you had a few little tweaks like color correction and very techie movie things to do to it. But I've already posted about having seen the film, and I'm being bombarded by listeners saying, well, don't just tell us about it. Where can we find it? How can we see it? When will it be shown?
Well, I'm happy to say we are really busy cranking up the momentum to get it out there.
The dates that Mary Beth provided were from 2023 and have been edited out. An updated way to access the film will be provided at the end of this interview.
And you know, what we really would like to do is particularly reach to the young folks, the younger generation, and in the Sunrise Movement and in Extinction Rebellion Movement, because all they've heard is that it's green and clean and should be used.
Well, we will take down the lies about nuclear, counteract it with the truth, as brilliantly put together as the two of you have in this film and in so many of the others that are coming out now. There seems to be this wash of really powerful films that either have come out or are in the process of coming out, all of which contradict the lies of the nuclear movement. And that, of course, is what this show is dedicated to. So I will be keeping as up to date as possible. Any breakthroughs you have, any new ways of people accessing the film, please get it to me immediately. I will get it out because, let's face it, you have covered in this film one of my two local nuclear nightmares, the other being Santa Susana Field Lab, only 30 miles away from my home. San Onofre is 70, and I've got a couple of sets of hills in between, but I have no illusions about being safe if those canisters start cracking and the radiation starts leaking. So whatever I can do to support this film, I have no compunctions at all, because it's the kind of work that deserves to go for Oscar viability, Oscar consideration, and I'm hoping that Netflix decides to pick it up.
Thank you for your wonderful vision. I love it.
Yeah, we've seen that there's an attempt at a nuclear revival going on, and the spate of films that are coming out now, we think, is part of a nuclear awakening to counteract the nuclear revivalism and recidivism, as you might call it. So thank you for your support and encouragement.
Thank you for being an overnight success with this film after more than 11 years of shooting it.
And I do want to say that, you know, there were three of us that did this. Morgan Peterson has just been brilliant, and we couldn't have done it without her.
And in the meantime, she's been having babies. She's just had two beautiful daughters in the last 3 years. So she has her hands full, but she's risen to the occasion.
And what better reason to fight against nuclear than children? As you can tell, I wish you every conceivable and inconceivable success with your new film. For now, Mary Beth Brangan and Jim Heddle and all of those you worked with, I want to thank you so much for having been my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Oh, thank you, Libby.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you.
Mary Beth Brangan and Jim Heddle, recorded in 2023, discussing their film, SOS, San Onofre Syndrome. Jim passed away 2 weeks ago, and our heartfelt condolences to his partner, Mary Beth Brangan. Know that his memory is and will always be a blessing. And I will always treasure his comment about me and my work, calling me, quote, a one-woman media conglomerate, end quote. Coming from him, that was an ultimate compliment. For those who wish to view Jim Heddle's work, take a look at SOS, San Onofre Syndrome. You can access it on Amazon Prime or Eventive, and we will have links up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 752. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, November 25th, 2025. You deserve to not miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat, and the easiest way to make that for sure is to get it delivered every week via email. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com. There will be a yellow opt-in box that pops up. Can't miss it. Fill in your first name and your email address, and every week you will get an email with a link to the show and a short description of its content. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, you can send it to us in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Any amount will help us out, and we really appreciate every bit of your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, that, as Margaret Mead said and was echoed in the opening comments by Jim Heddle, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So happy Thanksgiving, and whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's da bomb.